Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to Military Monday on the Right Stream Radio Network. I am your host, John Gresham, and we are coming to you from beautiful, at least it's beautiful today, Fairfax, Virginia. Mind you, yesterday we may have had gale force winds and sideways snow, sleet, and rain all at once, but today I'm almost ready to believe spring has finally gotten here, and thank God for it. We need it. And along with the better weather, we are going to have a show today that we originally planned for several weeks ago, but for various reasons we're unable to go ahead and put on. You would have to be on the far side of the moon and not very well connected not to know that there is an international crisis going on down in Southwest Asia, specifically in the region of the Black Sea. The disagreements between the Western world and Russia over the fate of the Ukraine and the Crimea Peninsula are a matter of public record and are obviously going on in real time right now. The American Secretary of State is talking to the Russian Foreign Minister. There are regular phone consultations between the President and his counterpart in Russia. But we're going to concentrate on the region itself today, and in doing so, we're going to talk about a place and a region that most Americans don't even know about, and that is the area around the Black Sea. Now, the Black Sea is actually connected to the Mediterranean. It is a warm water, deep water sea that has on its borders Turkey, several of the Balkan nations of Eastern Europe, Russia, and the Ukraine. And though most people don't know it, we've actually operated there before. Almost 100 years ago, we, for a few years, operated a naval squadron in the region, and we're going to have someone come on today and talk to us about that. Our guest today is Robert Schenck. He is a professor down in New Orleans. And are you there, Robert?
Yes, I'm here.
Robert, tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do normally? What's your day job? And why in the world did you want to write a book about a small squadron of American ships in the Black Sea 100 years ago?
Well, that's an interesting question because I'm an English professor. I've had a lot to do in the Navy with the Navy. I was in the Navy in the Vietnam War, and I was served at two service academies as a professor of English. But normally, I talk about Shakespeare and Milton and things of that kind. I got interested in a biography of a fellow who was both a literary figure and an admiral. His name was Admiral Dan Gallery. So a friend of mine and I decided we'd write a book about Admiral Gallery, a biography. And he lives and works at the Naval Academy. He lives in the region and works there. And we've got to know each other when I was on duty at the Naval Academy. Well, we decided to write a book about Admiral Gallery, and we began it and so on. But, of course, you know how archives are. John, perhaps you've dealt with these guys who are archivists. Well, they normally don't let you into the archives. You have to read from the list of what's in there and then ask for this pamphlet, this work, and so on. Gallery had donated his papers back there in, I don't know, in the 50s or 60s, probably the 60s, to the Naval Academy. So we were working out at Special Collections at the Naval Academy, and we got to know the archivist pretty well. So she let Herb and I walk back into the stacks occasionally. Well, this turns out to be important because they had never fully cataloged the gallery collection. Most of it was cataloged, but there were some other things that were not. One of the reasons was because Admiral Gallery, after he donated the collection, would keep coming back and saying, I want this manuscript or this thing or that thing, and so he'd keep fooling with the collection. Well, Herb then...
It's worth noting, by the way, that Admiral Gallery could be defined as a character.
Well, that's certainly true.
Colorful character at that.
Very colorful character. He was the fellow who captured the very inventive and creative, too. He was the fellow who captured the German submarine on the high seas during World War II. Quite an inventive thing to do. The U-505, which is now alongside the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, actually it's in the museum now. It's been put inside. Quite an exhibit ever since. Well, he had also written some fiction and so on, so we decided we'd write this biography. Herb went in to look at the collection and saw this extra material, which was not cataloged. In that material was a stack of what looked like, and they certainly were, flight logs, but down at the bottom of the stack, apparently ignored because they seemed to be flight logs, were four steno pads in which Gallery had written a diary of his entire time in the Navy for the first 4 years after he left the service in 19... he left the Naval Academy in 1920, went to the Olympics as a wrestler, and then served on a series of four or five different ships. Well, in the midst of that time, in 1922, he had been on the USS Pittsburgh, a cruiser, this cruiser was ordered to Constantinople for 6 months because of the concerns about maybe the Turks trying to take over the city or something to that effect, and the Americans in the city and in the region were might be under threat. Well, I didn't know anything about the Navy having been in Constantinople or in the region, the Black Sea region, at all. But I certainly soon became very fascinated by it because I discovered it had two characteristics. One, it was a terrific Liberty port. Great cruise ships were visiting all the time. There were young men, women of all kind, Greeks and especially young Russian aristocratic women in the area. There was liquor of all kinds, and this was at the same time as Prohibition back in the States. There was great music, and so it was a tremendous Liberty port. But at the same time, terrible things were happening just a couple of hours cruise away throughout the region. Enormous humanitarian crises, killings, massacres, death marches, breakup of families, and Navy ships were supervising evacuation. They were carrying some starving, terrified people from one port to another, things like that. All this was brand new to me, and it's not all that familiar to many people in the Navy that we ever were in the Black Sea. I became more and more interested. Noticed that the Bosphorus Strait, on which Constantinople or modern Istanbul is situated, is the divide that traditionally divides Europe and Asia. In a sense, it is the divide between Christian and Muslim worlds. It was at the time, certainly. And the period
still
involved,
is to a great degree.
Well, to a great extent, that's true. And the period involved great opposition between peoples that still oppose each other, Greeks and Turks, for example, and communist, then Bolshevik Russians, and free Westerners. So all of this became very interesting to me. So I decided I might try to research and write a book about this area. There was no book about the Navy in this period, only a few scattered articles, not many of those. I wasn't a historian, but I knew some fine books of naval history or something like that had been written by non-historians. I decided I'd try my hand at this. I had done a lot of naval books of one kind or another, and I'd also written some about the Richard McKenna, the author of Sand Pebbles, whose book was set in more or less the same time period, though on the other side of the world, the book about the China fleet. And so I thought I could do some of this account, and so I would have to do a lot of scholarly work, reading the secondary works on the subject, but I'd have to go and read the actual war diaries of the time, the official reports. Also, private diaries, journals, letters, scrapbooks, material in private hands. And I did this by looking at materials from the Naval Academy archives. Some officer would have died, and then there would be a report, and he had served in the Black Sea, and there would be a report about his offspring being in such and such a place. And so by sending letters out throughout the country, I was able to find and make contact with many, maybe as many as 30 people whose parents or uncles or relatives had served in the Black Sea, and got quite a bit of material that way as well. So I decided to work on it, and over a period of years, I focused on this subject. Going and when Mardi Gras happened down here in New Orleans, typically I take a week off during the Mardi Gras week and go to the National Archives or the Library of Congress in Washington D.C.
Okay, so you would escape the mirth, merriment, and debauchery and come up here and get cold for a week. I love that.
And read about the debauchery taking place in Constantinople for in that time period. Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
It was a way I could do it. Another time I'd come up here would be in May when the Blue Angels were flying right outside the special collections. In any case, I did a lot of work like that over a period of years.
Okay. So we now know why you discovered the subject and what motivated you. Let's go ahead and open up and say, let's talk about this region, and let's try and set the scene for our listeners of what that area of the world was like, because of all the places that changed as a result of the Great War, I think it's a safe statement to say none changed more than the region around the Black Sea, which is saying something when you consider the great empires and royal families that fell as a result of World War I. But in this case, an entire empire went away. Talk a little bit about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and what came after.
Okay, it is a very complex subject, and I'm afraid I won't be able to do justice to it, but I can tell you some things.
You have 50 words or less in 22 seconds, sir.
Yeah, right.
We're going to do a Ronald Reagan on you. Go ahead and give us 50 words or whatever it takes.
Well, we'll do a bit better, more than that. Of course, everyone knows that during the Great War, the World War I, in the middle of the war, Russia went through a revolution. By this time, the time the Americans came to the Black Sea, the American Navy, and so on, the revolution had more or less succeeded. There were a few, the Bolsheviks, the Red Russians, had succeeded in taking over most of the country. They were still fighting in 1919. They were still fighting in southern Russia near what we would know as Sochi, in that area, near the Aral Sea, a little bit north of that. They were still fighting. The White Russians were still fighting the Red Russians. But before long, they had to evacuate to the Crimea, which is that little... I guess you'd have to say sort of handle of the Black, if you regard the Black Sea as a kind of a large squashed pumpkin, then that's where the stem is. The Crimea is right at the top there. And so they had evacuated to the Crimea. There were White Russians fighting there, but most of Russia had been taken over by the communists, by the Bolsheviks. Turkey had been an ally of Germany during the war. And Turkey had been defeated. The British had won the war and come up from the south taken over Turkey. The Ottoman Empire had been going for something like five centuries. It was in charge from Constantinople as its headquarters. Constantinople, again, is modern Istanbul. And it had had charge of all the Middle East, basically, and up through, and North Africa, too, and then up through Eastern Europe. But by this time, Much of the last couple of hundred years, the Ottoman Empire was crumbling, and by this war, not only was the Ottoman Empire more or less kaput, but Turkey had been defeated too.
It was called by many people the sick man of Europe, correct?
Well, that's true. That was a famous phrase. And, of course, Europeans dabbled in the politics there as much as they could, too. A lot was going on. Well, at the same time, then, lots of nations were trying to make something of all this Turkey and take some of it for themselves. The Italians were. The French tried to take over some of southern Turkey. And then the Greeks were invited in by the Allies to help them control the populace, but then they simply began taking over Western Turkey. Well, that didn't set well with the Turks, and so a colonel in the Turkish army, a hero from the World War I, named Mustafa Kemal, what we now know as Ataturk, began organizing the nationalist Turks throughout continental Turkey to try to defeat the French in the southern Turkey and also to try to defeat the Greeks, who seemed to want to take over a base in Turkey. And because what the Greeks were trying to do was to make a sort of empire of their own from all modern Greece through Thrace into northern Turkey and western Turkey, areas that for 2,000 years had a substantial Greek, ethnic Greek population, still were worshiping Christian, were Christians worshiping, but they were under control of the Ottoman Empire, but tolerated to a degree there. So the Greeks were trying to take over some of those areas in a kind of greater Greece. The Allies, who had won the war, especially Britain, France, and Italy, had more or less been demobilized, but they were still in Constantinople. They had battleships in the Bosphorus Strait. They were, and then they eventually took over the city itself and ran it with thousands of troops in Constantinople itself. America had never declared war on Turkey. Hence, although Americans were fully involved in the peace work in Paris, the American president was up there, they were not allowed in the Allied conferences about Constantinople. So America sent some destroyers, some ships, some yachts to start with to Constantinople, but only a few hundred men at the outside, whereas we had thousands of men in Constantinople in the armies and the navies of the Britain, of France, and of Italy. Now, beyond that, Americans were there for several reasons. They were mainly there to protect America and American interests. America had two colleges in Constantinople, Robert College for men and more famous, and Constantinople Women's College for women. It had many missionaries throughout the country because the Congregationalist Church had been running substantial mission stations in 25 different places in the country of Turkey, and then also there were Near East relief teams. There were relief teams, and they had been began to come right after the war because of what we now know as the Armenian genocide. Go ahead.
Yeah, now, give us a little background on this and why it remains so controversial to this day.
The Armenian genocide. Well, right. The Armenians lived in eastern and southern Turkey. They and the Greeks, both Christian groups, were living in these regions and had lived there for centuries, actually millennia. The Armenians claimed to be the first nation to have become Christian as a nation back in the 4th century AD. they were living there, and they had become more prosperous than many of the Turks. They had a business sense, and especially in the 19th century, there was a kind of an Armenian Renaissance. At the same time, they were beginning to think, well, we can't be subject to these to the Turks and be in this demeaning status, as known as infidel dogs. And so there were three Armenian nationalist parties which had developed. But when the Young Turks, a group that threw over the Sultan back in 1909, they had two of those parties had supported the Young Turks back then. Well, Turks thought the Armenians were disloyal. There were some people outside of Turkey who were manipulating things, and some Armenians from Russia or maybe even from northern Turkey had joined Russian armies, which made forays into the region. At any rate, vast majority of Armenians was loyal, but the Turks thought they were disloyal, and so Turkey began to seek a way to get rid of all the foreigners in Turkey, especially the Armenians, but also the Greeks, all the Christians, among other things. By orders from a group of, well, what you might call at least one or two of them, were thugs called the Young Turks in Constantinople. All the males were to be massacred, and the young men, the young boys, the women, and the old men were to be sent on deportations, which means, you know, to be settled somewhere inland, but basically they became death marches into the midst of Turkey. Usually the males were massacred, then all the women and the old men and children went off to be robbed everywhere, to be the women to be raped sometimes or made concubines if they were good looking or something like that, and many of them, of course, did not to survive. The number who were killed varies depending upon who you talk to, but it runs at least a million and a half by the best estimates in my judgment. Missionaries and American missionaries were still in Turkey, although many of the other Americans had to leave when America declared war on Germany. They saw what was happening and were overwhelmed by what they saw, and they reported back home. This news spread everywhere. The young historian Arnold Toynbee reported this in the famous Bryce Report, which every congressman got a copy of. Even some of us at my age remember our parents telling us to eat our food because of the starving Armenians, because that everyone...
You have to realize I grew up in Southern California, and there was a huge Armenian community in Long Beach where I was born.
Right. Well, many of them came to the States afterwards, but even while I remember this and other people remember things like this being told by our parents who were of age during the 1920s, it was a huge publicity campaign on what was happening to the Armenians. And so American conscience was deeply moved by all of this. Even before the war, people began to collect money to help those who had survived. And so there became a relief organization, and eventually it became a government organization, official government organization. And so one of the things the American ships were sent to do, besides to protect American interests, was to help the relief teams be transported throughout the region, because the only way you could get from one part of the region to another was half the time by a ship of some sort, and the Navy ships would transport the relief teams from the Bosphorus or from Constantinople, which was on the Bosphorus Strait at the far western end of the Black Sea, to the eastern end of the Black Sea, to Batum, a port in Georgia, and then go further east and then up by rail into Armenia to work with the people who were in great stress. But they also, those relief teams went throughout Turkey, all to all the American missions, which were already there as sort of bases to help. That was another reason the American Navy was sent, and it was one of their jobs was to transport and help the Near East relief.
Forgive me, Robert, but 100 years later, This sounds like one of the missions the Navy does on a regular basis is humanitarian and disaster relief. We're still doing this.
Well, it may, yeah, I'm sure we are. We go to the Philippines. We go to all the tsunami victims. If there's a Navy out, a ship at least, and several aircraft looking for the jet that went down, and so on. Yeah, it becomes one of our standard jobs. At this time, it was huge because we were helping people in Russia. We were helping people in Turkey, and there were American relief teams throughout Europe, and there were Navy ships that were involved in much of that, but we'll get to some of that, I guess, a little later.
And there were individual incidents that particularly galled the government and the people, including one at a place called Smyrna. Talk about that.
Well, it's a long story. Let's go into the little background of that. When the Greek army was fighting against the Turkish army in the middle of Turkey, for 2 years or so, the Allies had tried to build this new sultan up and let him take charge, but the Mustafa Kemal and the nationalists now organizing in Turkey, eventually at Angora, or modern Ankara, as their headquarters, were determined to get the French out of southern Turkey and to get especially the Greeks, the Greek army out of Turkey. The Greeks succeeded for several months in pushing further and further into Turkey. At one time, even Ankara, the capital, was threatened. First of all, the Turkish nationalists fought the French, who were trying to take over in southern Turkey, and they defeated the French. The French eventually left, and so they no longer tried to colonize Cilicia, or the southern part of France. But they were still having difficulties up in the middle of the western part of Turkey, and it took on for 2 years. Well, the Americans got reports upon this. Admiral Bristol, who was the naval commander of the area, and also a diplomatic head, because there was no longer an ambassador. Admiral Bristol heard about what was going on. He always kept the destroyer at Samsun, which was not far. Well, it was a couple of days travel to Angora, so he could get to know the nationalists and know what they were up to. He recognized the importance of Mustafa Kemal and the nationalists sooner than probably anyone than the other allies did. So he kept the destroyer there to find out, to make contact with these nationalists. Of course, one of his reasons was he wanted to promote American business. Well, one of the things that the nationalists did was to decide they had to look at their backs and they had to make sure that there was no revolt in the north coast of Turkey, what we call the Pontus. And so they sent a brutal general, Nureddin Pasha, sent him north to help control the northern area. And what he did was basically begin another series of very brutal campaigns and massacres, and he basically would take a village and eventually get destroyed all the villages of the Greeks in this part of the region, and massacred the men and sent the women on these more death marches, such as that occurred in 1915-16 against the Armenians. Now there was a Dolorosa of the Black Sea Greeks going south. We're talking about tens of thousands, maybe as many as 100,000, I can't tell you. Well, the Americans were going to the Black Sea ports of Turkey, such as Samsun and the further west, Trebizond, those two main ones, and they were reporting back to the Admiral Bristol what they saw. And I've been able to come up with many of these reports that are very hard to find in the files. I was able, because some of them kept these reports in their own files, took them home with them. They were not classified, but in those reports, the American sea captains were reporting upon 600 more Greeks deported south. 600 more Greeks deported south. And so Admiral Bristol kept most of this quiet. His notion was we got to do business with the nationalists, and so we have to you know, not give them too bad a reputation. If people know these things are going on, they'll never do business in the part of the country. So he kept these things quiet. But the Navy captains reported these things, and then at one point, two captains decided this was too much, and so one of them wrote a hand-penned message to the Admiral about more deportations were taking tomorrow and taking place tomorrow. He had protested against it, but he didn't think anything but an official American protest would do it, and he said, if we don't do something, we will be, as the Germans were had been during World War I, who were throughout Turkey, there and letting the great massacres and the terrible genocide take place. Another destroyer captain in the same place, then took a fast ship to Constantinople and reported this to the admiral. The admiral didn't want to hear it. He eventually relieved the ship captain because when he didn't get the admiral to do anything, this ship captain went to the Greek Orthodox patriarch and reported what was going on, and he went to Bristol and complained, and basically by this doing, he was reporting to somebody outside the admiral, outside the Navy. Bristol thought, and it probably was, you know, this was a kind of a terrible action. He was not reporting to the Navy. He shouldn't go outside without authorization, and so on. He wrote a terrible fitness report for him, which inhibited this guy's chance at ever making captain. He was a commander. Any rate, these guys took both of them in one extent or another, put their careers on the lines to tell the admiral something had to be done. Admiral didn't want to hear any of it, but he did send the USS St. Louis, which was commanded by then Captain William Leahy, to Samsun for maybe a month, 3 weeks or a month, to make the point clear. And he made a protested to Mustafa Kemal to stop these things being done. And apparently for a while, they stopped. The Secretary of State gave Admiral Bristol praise for having stopped the massacre taking place at Samsun. But after the ship left again and again, these things kept taking place until way back in September. Then by September, there were no more Greeks living in Samsun, where they started out with some 15,000. So they had been gotten rid of. Well, September 1922, the final battle took place. The Turks beat the Greeks. They retreated in disarray to the coast, and most of them were picked up by transport and carried out of the Greek transport, carried out of the area. But many of them, at least 6,000 Greek soldiers, were captured by the Turks and marched through Smyrna. The whole of the Turkish army descended upon Smyrna. Everybody knew what was going on. All the Navy ships of all the nations sent ships down there. There were some 20 warships in the harbor, including several battleships, several cruisers, and three American destroyers in the battle in Smyrna. For several days, refugees kept fleeing to Smyrna, afraid they were going to get killed if the Turkish army came upon them. All the Greek and Armenian, Christian, ethnic Greek and Armenian citizens of Turkey fled to the coast into Smyrna. All these great battleships were in the harbor, and other ships were in the harbor, and they expected something to be done for them, but they did very little or nothing at the time. Eventually, the Turks set fire to the city. Again, the Turks will, some historians will say it wasn't the Turks who did it, but all the American records of all the people who had been there, and American relief teams were on the ground trying to find food for all these hundreds of thousands of people in the city, and the naval officers' records indicate that American people at various colleges in the city, various girls' schools and so on, saw the fires being set. A great fire took place. The wind blew it towards the European center, and it burned this enormous city down, burned it to the ground. In the middle of the fire, everyone was fleeing to the harbor, to the great quay or quay, Quay, that lined the entire waterfront of this great business center, and there were herds of sheep, horses. There were refugees. There were people who lived in the city. Everyone fled to the waterfront. For days after the fire burnt the city down, there were hundreds of thousands of people there. Halfway through that time, the Turks basically marched people away from the waterfront, separated out all the young men they could find, and marched them inland to an uncertain fate. And then marched the other, let the other people back to go to the waterfront. Again, we have all these great ships in the harbor doing virtually nothing. Well, they were, each country was saving its own. If you were, a American citizen, you showed papers and perhaps you could get on a ship or a transport and be sent out of the place. But there weren't not a lot of transports around. The British brought some ships down, and the British people could get out. The French would stamp anybody who could speak a word of French. They'd stamp your passport and say you can go. And so on, but Italians were letting people go and so on, but it just didn't make a dent to this vast numbers of people on the waterfront, perhaps at least a couple hundred thousand, because that's so many who got out. Admiral Bristol had given orders that the Americans were to stay neutral, and so they could not do anything for these other people. Only Americans were allowed to go out. And so nobody in the whole Allied force was doing anything to get ships and take these people away. Finally, an American missionary named Jennings decided he had to do something about it. Went to a ship he saw that he thought might be take some people aboard. They said, "Sure, we'll take some people aboard, maybe 2,000." But the next morning, of course, the Turks were there saying, "Well, you can only take." Young women, young children, and old men. No men. You can't take any military age men. And there were great family separations. A terrible time through all of this period, and so on. He rode that ship to the harbor at I think it's known as Lesbos, Mytilene, and the capital of the place, and noticed. There were 20 Greek ships, of all things. They were the transports which had taken the Greek soldiers away. And finally, he tried to get somebody to let him take these ships back to Smyrna and evacuate people with these ships. At one point, he had to, in fact, threaten just to put it on the news that the Greek government had not allowed it. With that kind of threat, the Greeks finally said, "Okay, you're in charge of all the ships in the Mediterranean, in the Aegean Ocean. You're all in charge of all the Greek ships in the ocean. Go ahead and transport these ships inland to Turkey and take the refugees away." He had become essentially a commodore in charge of a fleet. And this is a guy who didn't know anything about ships other than to be sick aboard them. Just a little ordinary missionary, a YMCA worker. But with coordination between he and one of the American officers who had gone around Bristol's orders to this extent, one way or another, he got the ships to go. He got 10 of the ships to go. The other captain said, "Oh, there's something wrong with my ship," and so on. But he got 10 of them to go to Smyrna with an American naval escort, and they began an evacuation. Meanwhile, the Turks have given orders, if anybody's still here by, October the 1st, we'll send them to the interior, which they all regarded as a death threat. So everybody was frantic. And they began to evacuate the people. And for the next week, then, these ships kept coming and going, usually to Mytilene or to one of the local islands to get these people out of Turkey. And they evacuated almost exactly, just under 200,000 people. The Navy ships did. Again, none of this was... go ahead.
This is obviously a very large evacuation, even by contemporary standards. And I think it might help our listeners to understand, how did our commitment to having a force in the Black Sea begin? And let's talk about it in terms of the ships involved, because you talked about them initially being yachts, and then a couple
right.
of destroyers, and
That's
then
right.
eventually becoming a more impressive squadron with cruisers, destroyers, and support vessels. Give us a sense of what these ships were like, how they arrived, when they arrived, and sort of how did the force grow and evolve over this period of 4 or 5 years?
Okay, the ships started out, the one ship which was there all this time was the ambassador's yacht. It's called the USS Scorpion. It was a steam yacht. Once upon a time it had guns on it. They'd been taken off, and it was basically an entertainment vehicle, and it did cruise up into the Black Sea occasionally, but when most of the time it stayed there. But during the war, during World War I, it had been interned when America entered the war in 1917, and it had been interned in the Golden Horn, the famous bay off Constantinople. So at the end of the war, the three officers and 90 people got back, so they could go ashore again and so on. And then a couple of other yachts came. Our armed yachts, large vessels that had been, one of which had been loaned by Jacob Astor to the Americans, and they were available, and the old cruiser Olympia was available, and they came steaming up.
Admiral Dewey's flagship, Battle of Manila
yes,
Bay, yeah.
That's right. It came up, and so on these ships, the Admiral and others took investigatory journeys to the ports around the Turkey to see what had happened and to report about what they could learn of the Armenian genocide and the other events that had taken place there. So these vessels took place for a few months, were there, and few subchasers as well, very small vessels, but very useful for making little runs here and there throughout the port. Before long, within a few months, although Admiral Bristol wanted the battleship, he got some destroyers. Of course, they're small, lean ships. They were of the four-piper destroyers, four-inch...
We called flush-deck four-pipers, which we built several hundred of during the Great War.
That's right, a few of which actually got into action, but some of which got into action. And that was, in a sense, you could say the Black Sea fleet was the heyday of the Four Pipers. That was the time when they went everywhere, did everything. They took the place of the yachts, which went home and were decommissioned. Occasionally, maybe especially the first 2 years, there was a cruiser present as well, and that was sometimes the St. Louis was the cruiser that was there. Sometimes four destroyers, sometimes six. It grew to eight, and eventually 12 of them were in the region. And then at the Great Burning of Smyrna, when the when the Turkish army marched towards Constantinople, the Americans decided they had to have a whole fleet there, so eight more came. So we had at one point then 20 destroyers there. It was a supply ship. There was a tender, and there was the cruiser Pittsburgh was in the region, so it was asked to come, some subchasers, and, of course, the Scorpion. There were some 26 naval vessels present at that time. And for maybe a year, starting with the burning of Smyrna afterwards, just after it, and then for the next year. And they had all sorts of things to do because, among other things, the Turks had decided to that we're not going to let any Christians stay in Turkey. So they insisted that everybody, all the Greeks and the Armenians who were left in Turkey, should leave the area within the next month or two. Of course, there's no way they could have gotten out within the next month. So here we have then, after Smyrna was burned, and after the final evacuation, which ended about October 1st, then everybody left, all the Greeks and Armenians, all the remaining Christians, even a group called Assyrians, were marched to the ports, who marched and walked, or they rode if they could have anything to ride, but they hundreds of thousands went to the ports of Turkey. And those same ships then were used, those Greek vessels were used to evacuate them. And almost all of those guys, by the way, Greeks and Armenians, were accepted by Greece. It was a huge number. The American relief teams were still then at the ports. They were everywhere where there was need for food, where they could provide food and any kind of doctor work that they could do. There was a group called the American Women's Hospitals Unit, which women at the time were not allowed as doctors in any organization, so they formed their own organization and came over. Any case, these people were marching to the ports. American relief teams were everywhere trying to help them. American Navy ships were going to ports and this port and that, reporting on what was going on. They did not, at this point, help in the evacuation. They had sailors that helped right and left in the Smyrna evacuation, and they had simply helped carry babies right and left to the ships and so on. But the American Navy, at this point, they simply kept going throughout all the ports of Turkey till hundreds of thousands, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands were evacuated, tens of thousands, according to the Greek historian I read, died, of course, in these sudden massive evacuations on the way out. So that's sort of the after they were all gone, then the question became, well, what happens next? Of course, by this time, the nationalists were in charge of every place in Turkey, and so now the question became whether they'd take over Constantinople. I realized that because they were threatening Constantinople, the army was, the Turkish army, they had guns up on the hillsides over the Bosphorus. But probably because the British, French, and Italians were occupying that city, therefore nothing happened to it like Smyrna, because in fact they kept the people who were there of all nationalities, of all ethnicities, Turks especially, but also Greeks, Armenians, and many others, and Europeans who lived in the city, because they were there and occupying the city, and they had the battleships in the harbor and so on. Probably nothing happened to Constantinople as it did to Smyrna.
And talk a little bit about the kinds of people that were sailors on the American squadron. You've talked a little bit about Admiral Bristol. You obviously got deeply involved in the life and career of a young ensign/lieutenant by the name of Dan Gallery. Talk a little bit about those gentlemen and the others that you discovered during your research for this book.
Well, okay, yeah. I mentioned Captain Leahy, You'll remember him, of course, as a fellow who was Roosevelt's chief of staff during World War II. He had been chief of naval operations. He was the commander of the cruiser St. Louis, which was sent to Samsun for about a month. And he was about in the area and wrote a very, very interesting diary of his six or eight months time in the area. Thomas Kincaid, famous in World War II as commanding the 7th Fleet during the Battle of Leyte Gulf and elsewhere, was a staff officer at Constantinople. Tip Merrill, again an admiral during World War II, a fighting admiral, was the intelligence officer at one point. And Arthur Godfrey, famous humorist, I guess you'd call him, was a radioman on a ship that was there briefly. Dan Gallery was an ensign on the Pittsburgh, and all of these guys, the younger people who were not already married, they had girlfriends, or they had a great time in the city, having drinking and dancing with the Russian waitresses at the various restaurants in the city and so on. And then the diplomat Alan Dulles was on the diplomatic side of the admiral's staff. Again, there was a diplomatic side as well as a naval side, and Alan Dulles was there for a year or so until he went to the Near East Division of the State Department, where he was sort of Admiral Bristol's guy back there at the State Department. And then, of course, a novelist Ernest Hemingway came for about 3 weeks, but he had malaria while he was there. Another novelist, John Dos Passos, passed through the area. The sailors were the American sailors of the day. They had a great time while they were in the city. They loved the Russian women and the Greek women. Some of them married the Greek women, as did some of the officers married the Russian, tended to marry the Russian women. I remember a story of one sailor, I think he was a steward, who had married a Greek girl, although it turns out that neither the sailor nor the Greek girl could speak the other's language.
It sounds like they had a universal language, perhaps.
Well, perhaps. In any case, the various there was a huge vice district there. There was a Greek and Russian and Armenian women throughout. Again, the cruise ships were visiting the city, and so the American officers, at least, would go out and visit the cruise ships and date the American women they saw there, or foreign women. Dan Gallery dated a Greek girl for about 3 months until the best friend aboard ship, his best friend, and this girl decided they loved each other, and Dan fell out of favor. Eventually the ship left, and the girl was left there, that was the end of the events. Although, again, some officers did marry the Russian women they ran into. There's a very interesting story about an officer, a young officer, on Gallery ship to Pittsburgh. He was on a destroyer. Ted Willings was his name. And Dan was on his way to his marriage to a young Russian girl in Constantinople. And then he got the word on the way that the admiral had talked him out of it, and he had shanghaied the young man home on an next destroyer. However, I got a hold of this guy's son, again in 2003, I think. I got a hold of this guy's son on the phone. He said, "Did you know, Bob, that my mother was a white Russian?" Turns out, apparently, the guy had sent passage money to this girl, despite what the admiral said, and married her back when she got to Boston. And there are lots of stories like that. The admiral didn't think it was as good for a young officer's career for him to be married to a foreigner. So that's what he was doing with this. You can imagine all the kinds of good times that people had ashore. It was an open gangway. Whenever your work was done, you just left, and so on. The ships would spend 4 to 6 weeks out at sea. They'd be going from one port to another port to another. They would go from Odessa to Novorossiysk to maybe Batum, and then to either Trebizond and Samsun. In other words, they'd spend a week or two at the ports in Russia, and then a week or two in ports in Turkey, and then he'd come back. And after 4 to 6 weeks, they'd spend a week or so at home in the Bosphorus Strait on the buoys right outside of the European quarter of Constantinople. And then, of course, when they have a great time in the city, and they'd go back out again. And then sooner or later, the admiral would send every one of these guys out to each one of the ships we send to the Holy Land and to Egypt. So they'd spend maybe 4 days in the Holy Land and 4 days in Egypt. I don't know if usually it was in Egypt and then the Holy Land. So they'd get to see the sights of the area. I think almost every ship that the admiral had went that direction. He had these ships for maybe 6 or 8 months apiece. They'd steam from Norfolk. They'd come over. These are, again, almost all destroyers with a few cruisers and some subchasers. He had them all. He'd have them there for 6 months, and then they'd steam home. And at least once during that time, they'd go down to Egypt and the Holy Land. And so, again, everybody had a great time, of course, visiting all the sites in Egypt and the Holy Land. But on the shore, you'd also go see the whirling dervishes. You'd go to the Grand Bazaar, which is still there, a great place where you could buy all sorts of things of all kinds. And then you could visit all the great sites in Constantinople itself, the cisterns, the great cisterns under the city. You could see the famous mosques. You could go into the mosque, the old church, Hagia Sophia, or Holy Wisdom, the old Byzantine church built, I don't know, 5th or 6th century, which had been turned into a mosque, is now a museum, and so on. There were great sites to be seen right in Constantinople itself, as well as in all the ports they visited.
Another name that comes up, and we're going to need to start to wrap this up here before long, but another name that comes up during this period is a future president, Herbert Hoover. Talk about why he figures in the story of the American Black Sea Squadron, and what was his significance in European relief efforts during this period?
Yes. He at one point, first of all, I won't spend any time on this, but I mentioned at one point that the Russian army was had fled to the Crimea. Well, a few months later, they had to flee to Constantinople, and overnight, 145,000 white Russians, fled into the city of Constantinople. Some of them had come on American Navy ships. The Bristol, when he heard about it from his friend Admiral McCulley, who was an observer with the White Russian Army, sent his ships up there, and they brought maybe they carried only a few thousand home, but they towed ships which were derelicts, everything that had French, Russian ships, everything that could sail at all had been taken by the refugees to get out of the city. All these white Russian refugees had come to Constantinople in November of 1920. Well, a little later, in mid-1921, I believe it was, Maxim Gorky, the famous Russian novelist, had made a plea to the West to do what they could to solve the great famine striking all of southern Russia. All of southern Russia was in great distress. There were people dying and starving wherever they went. People were traveling both ways on all the railroads because they didn't know where any food was to be found. And there was a massive, likely catastrophe at hand of the death of millions in southern Russia, partly from Bolshevik policies. They had robbed all the peasants of everything they had, including the seed corn by which they would plant the next crop. And so there was no food available. Well, politically, some people said, well, let the Russians fry in their own grease. Let the Bolsheviks did it, so let them deal with it. But many others, including Hoover decided we had to do something. So they sent a request for the American Navy people in Constantinople to check out the search, for Admiral Bristol to have his ships check out the situation. Bristol sent a destroyer up to, I think it was Odessa, to several ports, to check out what ports could be used, whether they had any rail transportation, which was in any shape, because, of course, after the revolution, it's all been rusting away, and to see what the relations with the Bolsheviks were. Well, the Bolsheviks pretended to be tough and all that sort of thing, but said you can't have your radio on board. And by the way, soldiers have to stand on your ship. Well, he didn't. The American captain of the Gilmer said, "Well, we'll just get underway if that's what you feel about it." But they backed off then, and soon they backed off enough for the Gilmer to send a message that, in fact, they could, use these Black Sea ports for some of the great grain ships that they were planning. And so, under Herbert Hoover, we had a great massive shipments of grain to both the Baltic, which, however, froze up in the wintertime, and to the Black Sea. These great grain ships would come directly from American ports through the Mediterranean, through the Aegean, up through the Bosphorus, through the Dardanelles and the Sea of Marmara, the Bosphorus, right on to the ports in southern Russia. But then the Navy would escort the American ships into port, would intercede with the various captains ashore, and would organize some of the much of the events that took place thereafter. That was kept quiet because people didn't want the Navy to be, widely known that the Navy is involved in this, and that they're helping the Bolsheviks or something like that. So, but at any rate, so for 2 years, ships at Odessa and Novorossiysk, which is not far from Sochi, and in other ports in the Crimea itself, ships were there, and they would be offloading grain, which would then be carried hundreds and thousands of miles inland throughout southern Russia. They also sent medical teams there to try to stop any disease that was associated with the famine. So, this was a massive success in fact, stopping the great Russian famine. And although the Soviets gave Americans little credit for it, in fact, we saved, who knows how many millions of lives in this way. It took a year and a half. By that time, the seed crops, the peasants had gotten more seed from the Americans than they could plant their own. Yellow Russian corn, which was yellow American corn, which was strange, new to the Russians. So, in this way as well, we have this this great outpouring of American help, and Herbert Hoover was the guy who spearheaded that back in the States, and it was called the American Relief Association, which had done a lot of work in Europe that did that part. It wasn't the Near East Relief Association, but again, that took a year and a half to 2 years, and American ships were kept there for all that time. Rotating vessels were kept there, making sure that there was at least two ships in America, in Russian harbors all that time.
So this is a substantial relief effort that goes on for a period of months. And there are, of course, the famous Hoover grain ships that deliver the grain. And
that's right.
They become a part of American humanitarian history.
That's right. It was a major effort. A lot of people didn't want to do it, didn't want to help. But some people thought, well, we can do it. Maybe we can thereby start a revolution or something like that. That wasn't ever likely. But we did it out of humanitarian, out of the goodness of our hearts, I think, as we did with the Near East Relief group. So there were enormous people, groups of people going out and trying to do what they could in these great circumstances. And the Navy was involved in that effort.
So how does the How does the squadron begin to wind down? What are the circumstances which see it begin to draw down in numbers and in importance, and how do we eventually leave the region?
Well,
how do we eventually leave the region?
Right. The nationalists had taken over. They'd taken over all of continental Europe. That is to say, everybody, every place but the part of all of continental Turkey. Everybody except the part of Turkey. Every place except the part of Turkey that's on the European side, mainly Constantinople and the local regions there. They'd taken over the place. And moreover, they had also began to infiltrate and have a lot of people in Constantinople itself. It became evident that the guy who was in charge, Mustafa Kemal, was going to be in charge. He decided at that point when he took over, and he would take over in September, I believe, of 1923. And this, again, remember, is after all the war has been taken place, and all of the Christians had trekked to the ports and tried to get out and were transported to Greece. He decided that would be the time when all the Americans and Europeans would have to leave, including all the vessels in the harbor, all the thousands of troops in Constantinople, all the British, French, and Italians would have to leave, all the warships would have to leave the harbor. And so although the Americans had been good friends to the Turks by Admiral Bristol, to a fault, by Admiral Bristol's directions, they had to leave as well. So that's it was a pretty much everyone left by then. I draw down a little bit, but then they all left in that September of 1923. And Admiral Bristol did stay on for 4 years as a kind of he was no longer had a naval arm, but he was more or less ambassador there. They eventually, 1928 it was, when they actually appointed an ambassador. Some had thought that Admiral Bristol should be the man, but they appointed someone else. But the point is, it was fairly quick. Once the aid was done in probably in late 1922, early 1923, most of the problems with the Air American aid to Russia were over. And so gradually the ships left those ports. And around all the ports in Turkey, of course, there were these great exoduses which were taking place, and so American ships still had to be around checking on that, reporting on it, asking for more ships to come, and so on. American Near East relief teams now were also leaving the area. Some thought that they should, Admiral Bristol thought they should go home and let the Greeks handle their own problem. A lot of these people, of course, were not Greek who were being leaving. In a sense, they're not Greek. They didn't speak Greek. They were Christians. They were ethnically Greek, they had nothing to do with the war, but the American relief teams went to Greece to help with what was left of the great, huge refugee problem. Then Greece, of course, had 1.5 million, a couple million people, new people living in Greece in an enormous change. There was later a population exchange between Greece and Turkey. Most of the Turkish citizens who were ethnically Armenian or Greek had left by then. Turks living in some areas of Greece and that in Thrace and that region came to Turkey, and some who were remaining of the Greeks were repatriated to Greece. Do realize that of all the people who were repatriated, very few of them were male. Most of the males of that generation had been killed. They'd been killed in one way or another. Some of the members of the Greek army and many of the military-age males in Smyrna and that whole region were put into labor battalions. But in those labor battalions, they were fed very little, not enough to survive till the next year. In any case, the whole effort of all parts of the effort of not only some American educational institutions, the Robert College and Constantinople Women's College stayed, some of the missionaries stayed, although not to any extent, because the missionaries have been primarily working with the Greeks and Armenians. And so many of those mission stations also ended. Some colleges from Turkey, American colleges, or what we would call junior college, set up in Greece and so on. By September 1923 or thereabouts, all of those things wound down, and that whole episode, certainly of the American Navy, was ended.
So here we are almost 100 years later, and we're watching another set of crises in the region. And looking back, what do you think the legacy and lessons of the Black Sea Squadron were, and what should we be remembering as we think about operating and doing things in that region? What are, in your mind, the dynamic forces one needs to keep an eye on in that part of the world?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm not a historian and not all that, and I can't speak too much to what's happening now. I think the one thing, American Navy simply had a humanitarian mission then. It certainly has great humanitarian missions now. American Navy helped in these efforts that saved millions of lives. There's no question. Here, there, the other place. I should say that it's important the individual acts of conscience that took place. For example, in the night of the Great Fire at Smyrna, two Americans went to the admiral's chief of staff, who was at Smyrna, the Captain Hepburn, and said, "Look, we got to do something for all these people on the pier who are going to be burned to death." And he said, "Well, we can't do anything, but you might go over to see the British." So they went to talk to the British, and the British admiral said, "No, we can't do anything either." Now, the reason they talked to the British, because they had big boats that they could, whereby they could evacuate people, and they could take them to some of their own ships. But the chief of staff apparently argued to the British admiral so vehemently that he changed his mind, and he sent all the boats he had, these big barges that he could, you know, and that could evacuate many people from the pier, and apparently that night they saved 20,000 people, according to one estimate. For example, and so individual acts of conscience like that, and there's another one in the same time period. Americans were not the only people supposed to be evacuated by the American ships. But the people from the local college had sent some American women who were in charge of the teaching at that college, but they also sent some Armenian girls along with the women, thinking nobody would have the heart to turn these women down. Well, Captain Hepburn, remembering his orders only evacuate Americans, said, "You can't bring those women with you. But apparently the executive officer of the ship he was on, the American ship he was on, argued again with such vehemence to the admiral, in this case the captain, that he said, "Okay, put them below ships," and he took those Armenian girls out aboard a Navy destroyer as well. So there were individual acts of conscience as well. Another thing strikes me is the importance of reporting what you see. In the reports of American military men and civilians from Smyrna, simply telling the truth of what they saw then, we are able to get a very good understanding of what's going on. So when some try to cloud or hide what was happening, as Turkish government officials have often tried to do, or when propagandists on either side try to blow up something out of proportion, from those naval records and then from the official records and then what they say later and from the records of civilians, we're able to see a great deal of the truth of what was happening there. Other thing I'd say is the need for good people on the spot. Admiral Bristol was not the best guy to have sent down to these places. He had really no heart, no concern for the suffering that was going on everywhere. A great need that was there for this terrible, in this place with all these terrible things taking place, for intelligent senior officers with wide understanding and vision. I would have said, I would guess that Captain William Leahy would have been 100% better than Bristol. He wasn't an admiral at the time. He couldn't have done it. But somebody like him, he was the only American officer who was always thinking what he might do militarily to set things right. He, or at least he, in conjunction with the other officers, other senior officers, the admirals of the British, French, and Italian warships there in Smyrna, would have done something to set things right. He would have gotten them to come up with some policy. He would have been able to command the city with the guns out of the warships and stop the Turks from coming in until everybody was gone. Bristol had no idea of what was going on in Smyrna. He really never did, and what his policies were doing there. He didn't want anything to do with it. Leahy would not have been so utterly oblivious. So I know you can't have people in your Navy who have, been, studying politics and history all their lives, but you certainly have to have people with intelligence and wide vision and understanding and human sympathy to understand what's going on. And it seems to me you have to choose your officers well.
And with that, I'd like to go ahead and close this out and say thank you so much for coming on. And thank you to your publisher, U.S. Naval Institute, who published your book, America's Black Sea Fleet. The folks there have been very, very kind in not only supplying you to us, but others, which takes us to the question, what's next for Robert Schenck? What are you going to do next? I mean, obviously, you're going to continue teaching English and literature down in New Orleans, which sounds like actually a pretty good place to be right about now. But what else is ahead for you in the near future?
It's beautiful out here today. It'll get hot and humid later in the summer, but in the springtime it's wonderful. I couldn't tell you. There is a possibility. Well, there is this book that's not been written that needs to be told, but I'm not sure that's one for me to do. It's not about the Navy. It's about all the American women missionaries and relief workers who were in this area. There are, someone has counted up, 300 archives, 300 collections from all these American people who were everywhere in Turkey, the missionaries who were very much closer to the, in many things, what's on the ground than the Navy people were, and who had faced great crises of themselves by themselves. And this is a tremendous story. But it's an awesome endeavor to try to come up with all of that, and I'm not sure that I'm the guy to do it. But that's one thing that I thought of. But really, I haven't gone into another project here. I'm sort of at marking time. I've been done doing this project now for 10 years up until I finished the book, and the book actually was published. So I'm sort of in marking time mode right now.
Well, with that, I'd like to say thank you for having come on. And when you get another project finished, give us a call, and we'd like to have you on because you're a great storyteller. And thank you for coming today. We do appreciate it.
You bet, John. Great to be on. Thank you very much.
Take care, sir.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And with that, we are finished with another edition of Military Monday. We will be back next week with a really special show, one that you're going to just love, because our guest is going to be the great Sandy Grimes. Now, if you don't know who Sandy Grimes is, Sandy Grimes is a former, now retired, CIA operations officer, case officer. She was a spy. There's no question of that. And Sandy Grimes is the lady who went and led the investigation that found and brought down Aldrich Ames, one of the greatest moles in American history. I hope you'll join us for what I know is going to be a really, really great show. Take care. Have a great week.
I took a flag pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a dead man to me. I never loved a soldier until there was a war. I thought about tomorrow till my baby hit the floor. I only talk to God when somebody's about to die. Never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all. You can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. Pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.